a certain knowledge that I would remain useful in this program. And I told you yesterday of the trouble I had with this feeling that I didn't belong, that it was very strong with me, and I suffered from it. I just had it. Well, the 12 and 12 tells me this. Perhaps one of the greatest rewards of meditation and prayer is the sense of belonging that comes to us. We are no longer live in a completely hostile world. We are no longer lost and frightened and purposeless. The moment we catch even a glimpse of God's will, the moment we begin to see truth, justice, and love as the real and eternal things in life, we are no longer deeply disturbed by all the seeming evidence to the contrary that surrounds us in purely human affairs. We know that God lovingly watches over us. We know that when we return to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And it really isn't so much that Don and the rest of you do me the honor, the great honor of being here with you for the weekend. The fact of the matter is, I belong here. I'm a member. It's okay for me to be here. It's all right for me to be here. I fit in here. I'm entitled to be here, for God's sake. I'm a member of our Hearts and Hours. Why can't I be here? Because that sense of belonging has come to me. When I say my name, as I do, and I tell you that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a member of the Miami Men's Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, what I'm really telling you is who I am, what I am, where I belong. And that's important to me because for many years I didn't seem to belong anywhere. There's a poem in here, in AA Comes of Age, very much describes me. I learned this poem when I was in high school. It was written by a very well-known Catholic poet of 18th century England. His name was Francis Thompson. And Francis, in addition to being a poet, was a failed cleric. He had taken orders in the Catholic Church, but he had failed. He was also an opium addict and an alcoholic. And he went from being a cleric to living in the worst part of London. And he was born to a good family. And he writes a poem describing his relationship with God. And the poetic imagery he used is unusual. He pictured God as a large dog, a hound. And he called his poem "The Hound of Heaven." And he pictured himself trying to get away from God, this large dog, and everywhere he went, the dog kept following. And this is what he said, and this is me. He said, "I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinth and ways of my own mind. And in the midst of tears, I hid from him. And under running laughter, up vistaed hopes I sped, and shot precipitated down titanic glooms of chasm fears, to avoid those strong feet that followed after." And he describes God, he says, "with unhurrying chase, an unperturbed pace, with deliberate speed and majestic instancy, they beat, and a voice beat, more instant than the feet. All things betray thee, who betray me. And he has this dog following him. It's too long, I can't read you the whole thing. But he finally comes face to face with this hound. And the hound speaks to him and says to him, and this is exactly my case, God says to Francis, all which I took from thee, I did but take, not for your harm, but just that you might seek it in my arms. All which your child's mistake fancies lost, I have stored for thee at home. Rise, take my hand, and come. See, I thought that everything I had was lost. I thought that. I thought everything I had was gone. I thought everything had been taken from me. And it had. You know, my ability to be a law teacher, my opportunity to do that, my sweet relationships with my children and my family, my loss of my friends, all the other things. I thought, we're gone, and we're gone for all time. And it wasn't true at all, because I got them all back here. And he took them, as it says, he stored them for me at home. And finally, God speaks his last words to Francis, because he's got Francis backed into a position where he can't get away from him. And he looks at Francis, and he says to him, ah, fondest, blindest, weakest, I am he whom thou seekest. And I think that poem very much expresses my experience with prayer and meditation, with the seeking of an understanding to improve my conscious contact with God. I do not understand God. I am not a theologian. I have no knowledge in that area. But I have an effective understanding. And that is the power that came into my life, came into your life, brought us together for a meeting such as this, that has guided my life for more than 25 years, has given to me everything that I thought I'd lost, has restored me to a place in the scheme of things where I am at home and I do belong. And my understanding is that this power has brought this to me through you and through those wonderful old Irishmen that were there at the group I first went, through my sponsor. Because we, you and I, are the instruments that he uses. It certainly isn't the coffee, not the tables and the chairs. It's the power, which I read to you yesterday, is within us. You have some. I have some. Individually, we have none, but we, together, are very, very powerful. and it is no less, no less than the power of God. And on the 11th step, I leave you with the words of the book. On the 11th step, at the end of its discussion, our book says this: it works. It really does. Thank you. I have some announcements in addition to the tapes, which are available here. Of course, everything I've said is covered in my book, Humility and Beyond. I also have the 12-volume series as Ray Sees It. You like to get it? I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, like all of us, I suppose, to stop drinking. I did not come into Alcoholics Anonymous to become a Christ-like figure or a spiritual giant. It just sort of worked out that way. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, see to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. And before I end all of this, I have to tell you that I consider this weekend to be a great event. That has certainly come to pass for me, and I hope for others. Last night, basically, I think what I was trying to talk about, I never know how it's going to come out, was a communication with God through prayer. Trying to get knowledge of God's will for us. I don't suppose that I will ever know God's will. I don't know God's will, and I don't know who does. And I don't even know if it's possible to know God's will. But I certainly know where I've been all this time. I know what's happened, and I know that that saved my life. And allowed me to be useful to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don and I were talking yesterday, and we're both very, very fortunate because we've each found a niche, a place in life where we really enjoy what we do. My teaching is really just sort of a full-time teaching, 6 hours a week. I spend all my time in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're both allowed to do that. And I consider it to be a great gift because I have really spent this time trying to find out what God's will is. I don't know what that is. But I do know where the power to carry it out is. That's at the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous is the power by which I live my life. It's a very simple thing to come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't just go around the country and talk. I go 2, 7, or 8 meetings a week, doing that for a long time. Because that's where the power is. Today, this morning, we talk about the 12th step, which, of course, is the last and the ultimate step. And it says that the men and women who founded this program had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. This is it. This is the result. Spiritual awakening. There is no other result. Now, when I first came here, I had no interest whatever in spiritual awakening. In fact, I don't think I'd ever heard the term. I know the words. I mean, I know the English language, but I don't think I'd ever heard that term. And he said to me very early on that I would have a spiritual awakening. He said that. And I told him, I don't need one of those. What I need is money. And he said, well, you just go to the meetings and we'll see about that. The 12 and 12 has a discussion of the spiritual awakening, which I always thought fit me pretty good. In this it says, maybe there are as many definitions of spiritual awakening as there are people who have had them, but certainly each genuine one has something in common with all the others. And these things which they have in common are not too hard to understand. When a man or a woman has a spiritual awakening, the most important meaning of it is that he has now become able to do, feel, and believe that which he could not do before on his unaided strength and resources alone. He has been granted a gift which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. He's been set on a path which tells him he's really going somewhere. The life is not a dead end, not something to be endured or mastered. In a very real sense, he has been transformed because he has laid hold of a source of strength which, in one way or the other, he had hitherto denied himself. He finds himself in possession of a degree of honesty, tolerance, unselfishness, peace of mind, and love, of which he had thought himself quite incapable. What he has received is a free gift, and yet usually, at least in some small part, he has made himself ready to receive it. And I think that was true in my case. In the appendix to the Big Book, when the Big Book was first published, and it had these steps, and it had the discussion in the book about Bill's experience in the hospital room and all of that. After a little time had gone by and the book was in sort of general circulation, the little office they had in New York began to get letters. And the letters were coming from all over the country. And the letters said something like this. It said, "Here we are out in Dumpsville, Kansas. And there are five of us, and we're meeting twice a week in the church. And the room has not lit up yet. What are we doing wrong? Please advise," you know? And these letters were considerable. People were waiting for the wind to blow. And the only time the wind blew was when I was in town. And so in the second edition and in the third edition, which I have in front of me, they put in Appendix A. And Appendix A is in there to show the difference between a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening. They define a spiritual experience to be exactly what happened to Bill, a sudden, unasked for, uncontrollable phenomenon. The room lights up, wind blows. We have a book in our Quarks and Diamonds called Came to Believe. Many people don't read much about that book. That whole book is a description of a variety of spiritual experiences that individual members have had over the years. I have had a number of spiritual experiences, real ones. The first one I had scared the life out of me. But I've had a lot since. And I just don't trust them. You know, they come and they go, "It's very nice. Once you're used to it, it's very nice, you know. I see things, I hear things." I mean, it might be just schizophrenia for all I know, but it doesn't embarrass me to talk about it. I see things and hear things all the time. It's interesting, but it's not what the step is about. The step then goes, the appendix then goes on to explain the spiritual awakening. And they explain it in educational terms. They say, and they quote James, and they say it's of the educational variety. That is to say, you get it grade by grade, as we have been educated, you and I. We go from first grade to the end. And each year we learn a little more, and in our context, it's step by step. Until you get to the very end, and then the result is this. It goes on to say that what they really have in mind is a profound alteration in our reaction to life. How we react. We react differently. And you know, they say all the time, he sees things differently. We react differently. Used to, in my, you know, drunken days, if you didn't like my tie and told me that, I would feel justified in burning down your house with your children in it. Because that's how I'd react. Rotten son of a bitch, you know? And I'd throw you nasty and all. We react. I react differently now. I see it differently now. Book says of people who are offensive, they are sick people. Pray for them. Whole different reaction to life. And this is what we get. We don't get, doesn't say a word in here about job, money, or family, lovers, cars, or airplanes. Now, I suppose when I was new, that's what I wished it had said, you know? As a result of these steps, we got our jobs back, our families back, the house is back, the mortgage paid off, the partners quiet down. Not it. What we get is this, and it's really all right, too. I don't think I was ever so bad, in the sense that I don't think I was ever evil. I was just made a lot of mistakes, a lot of errors of judgment, things like that, and I behaved fairly outrageously the way we all did. And what it amounts to is what I mentioned in the first session we had here, that the good in me, whatever that is, was just covered over with layers of defect, character, and shortcoming. And that good, which is the spirit, which is part of God, I think, as the book says, deep down, in every man, a child, is that basic guy notion. And that deep down in me was covered over. And so as I went through this program, I went through the steps with the help of a sponsor and a group, layer by layer, the defects and the shortcomings were exposed and dealt with, and the amends were made. Finally, those promises that are in the book, in the discussion of the ninth step, began to flow into my life. So I knew a new freedom. The new happiness. And in my case, those were brand new because I never had a freedom. And I never had happiness. I had pleasure. Lots of times, pleasure. Getting laid is pleasure. Happiness is a different thing. It's an ongoing thing. And now I can say to you that I live a life and I experience happiness practically all. Very happy with my life. I'm content. There's nothing that I would change. There is no one or any institution that has anything I want from them. I just don't want it. I want what I have, and I want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's good enough for me. It's been good enough for me for a long time. And oddly enough and selfishly enough, I found out that by being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got all the rest. You know, I was born with nothing. I really was born with nothing. I came here with nothing. This program. Now I really think I have everything. Amazing. And that's why every day of my life I'm conscious of the power, mercy, and gifts. Once again, I'm not a religious person. If anything, I'm an earthy person. I like pleasure. I like good food, good places, women, song, don't use wine. And that's all a different attitude than ever I had. Because now when I have pleasure, when I have happiness, I'm happy to share it. Before I was. Great difference. And this is the message that we have to carry. It says, carry this message. This message. The message of Alcoholics Anonymous is the message of the spiritual awakening and nothing less than that. And I have an obligation, I feel, although no one has appointed me. Well, they should. To make sure, at least in my case, that there is no dilution of the message. I think, my opinion again, that anyone who sponsors someone and tells them they will get a job, that she will come back or he will come back, that the legal difficulties will go away, is absolutely full of shit. You don't know that. There's no indication of that in the program. Maybe it will, and maybe it won't. The book is very, very clear on this. In working with others, the book says, job or no job, wife or no wife, let no man say that he will not become sober until his family comes back. Goes on to say, we have seen men whose families came back and they got drunk. And we have seen men who have never regained their families and they have stayed drunk. And it starts off by saying, let no man say that. Don't even let him say it. A woman came up to me. I intimidate people. A lady came up to me in Florida just before I moved up to Michigan. And she said, do you speak to women? I said, sure. Yeah. What do you want? So, well, I'd like to meet you and talk to you next week. I said, all right, I'll come here early. It's not my group. I'll come here early and you can talk to me. I said, well, I want to tell you something. I said, what? I said, I don't want to hear about your husband, your children, or your job. He said, what else is there to talk about? I said, goodbye. And I came back the next week and she wasn't there. Let nobody say it. I don't even let them say it. It wasn't her. Anybody, my, you know, people I sponsor, ask not. I hold up my hand like a traffic cop. Not important. Not important. And you know, to a new person, it is important. I know that. But you see, they get distracted. The legal troubles go away and they go, whew, I'm off the hook. Bang. Okay? Girlfriend comes back. Whew, back in the saddle again. Bang. No good. And it's difficult. Really is. It's a difficult thing, in my experience, a difficult thing. As my sponsor found it with me, to carry this message. But the English language is the English language. It says exactly what it says. I don't make these words up. This is the message we have to carry. That there will be a change in the reaction to life. That change will enable this new person to live as you and I live, without not only the necessity of drinking, nothing, but to be usefully, as the Proverbs 12 said, usefully, happily, whole life. And the step goes on to say, we carry this message to alcoholics. I know I'm going to offend somebody, that's too bad. The English language. I have no message for someone nor am I asked to carry a message to anyone who is not an alcoholic. This program is called Alcoholics Anonymous. The name ought to give you a clue as to who gets helped here. Don't misunderstand. A lot of non-alcoholics come to Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of non-alcoholics come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Usually, in the general case, they are sent here by treatment. Because Alcoholics Anonymous works, and most of the other anonymouses are not so effective. Plus, the hospital's usually going to have the one van. Everybody in the van, here we go. They go to the AA meeting. All your overeaters get over here, and the gamblers over there. We only have the one van. They're not running a fleet. Everybody in the one van going to the meeting. And so we get a lot of non-alcoholics here. And we have a pamphlet on this called Problems Other Than Alcohol, which is a reprint of an article written by no less than Bill Wilson. And it's very clear that our program is for alcoholics. That is not to say, and I'm not an AA hard ass, I'm really not. I don't stand at the door and give saliva tests and determine who's a real alcoholic and who isn't. I don't give a shit. Let them all come in here. We're like a big self-cleaning oven. Let it all come in, and you look around a couple years later, and they're all gone away. Because this is not really the place for them. It will not hurt them. In fact, it'll help them. Nobody is hurt if they come. And around now, the cocaine addicts and the other drug addicts. This won't hurt them. It will help them. My experience is they won't stay that long. And my experience is that they will not help. Spiritual awakening the same way I do. Because this program is for alcoholics. And the underlying error, and it is a great error, is this is a lie. This is a lie. treatment center. That one addiction, that's all. It is not true chemically. It is not true medically. And it certainly is not true in recovery. Talking about different diseases. If you go out to your local supermarket right now, bring me back 100 people. First 100 you meet, bring them back here. Give me unlimited drugs. Go away. You come back a month later, I will give you 100 stone addicts who will do anything I tell them in order to get them. You do the same thing, you get the same 100. Give me unlimited alcohol. You come back 30 days later, I will be lucky if I can give you 8 alcohol. Dr. Jelinek, this disease used to be called Jelinek disease. Jelinek was the head of the Yale School of Alcoholic Studies, which is now at Rutgers. And Jelinek, who was not an alcoholic, told two of his associates he was going to become one in order to really study the disease. And Jelinek went out and he got himself a lifetime supply of booze. And he started to drink it. He got drunk. He passed out. He blacked out. He shit in his pants. And he never wanted another drink as long as he lived. He wrote it up. He didn't write it up that way, but he wrote it up. He never wanted to see alcohol again. Now, that's not us, right? Any more left, you know? What do you mean it's all gone? Jesus, get the car, get the money, get something. You know, we got to get more of this shit. That's not us. You know, we have stick-to-itiveness. We go up to that bartender in the morning and say, you got any more of that shit you sold me last night? You know that crap that wrecked the car, wrecked my marriage, lost my license to practice law? Put me in jail for saying, you got any more of that shit? I'll have a triple. You know? See, we have a part of our disease that thinks that way. And the addicts do not. They don't have that. They don't have that. Anybody can become an addict, but it takes stick-to-itiveness and gumption. And the message is for alcoholics, that's it. I mean, it's in the English language. Our traditions say that. Our fifth tradition says our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic. Now, it's not as though the founders of this program were not aware of the problem. Dr. Bob was addicted to barbiturates. He'd call them goofballs. He knew about this. When the first edition of the book were written, before it was written, I have a copy of it. I don't know if you've ever seen the thing that floats around. It's a mimeograph form that they had. Before they had a printing, they had a mimeograph form of the book which was circulated around to the members, and it's basically a draft. And the 12th step read, we carry this message to others, comma, including alcoholics, comma, and practicing. It was right in there. And we know as lawyers, and if you know legislative history and statutory construction, they had it right in front of them. And they took it out. And Bill said, and he says again in his article in Grapevine, and in his pamphlet working with others, we have a singleness of purpose. My message for the alcoholic. Believe me, I'm not putting anybody down if you're a drug addict. I wish you well. I wish you everything. But the fact of the matter is, you're not going to get from this program. Why that is so, I do not know. Why the other programs are not as effective as this, I do not know. I've only been to one or two or three of those other kind of meetings. I don't know. But my purpose is to carry this message. I am not a social worker. I am not a marital counselor. I'm not a first aid physician. Not the local bank. Now, from time to time, you end up to being all of that, as we all know. But that's not the purpose of it. It says in the book, well, you know, sometimes you got to take them in the house. And Don always had somebody in the house. besides 8 children, a wife, an English sheepdog, an organ, and a 3-ring circus, and a nanny.
Had a nanny.
That's an inside joke. But I'm not a social worker. You know, I'm not. And I don't try to be a hot ass, but people who deal with me in the context of the program know that. That's all I'm interested in. I'm interested in this. I'm not interested. I forbid them to telephone me. I don't know why anybody, they always ask me to sponsor, but I don't know why. I won't let them call me, because it's so easy to lie. I go to a meeting every night. Do you want to see me? You get to the meeting. I'll be there. Don't worry about it. Don't call me. Very busy. Very busy reading a book. But it's so simple to lie over the phone, right? My wife is sick. The only reason they call me is to tell me why they can't go. Because they know I'm going, and now they want to make sense. I want to hear that. Either they go, or they don't go. If they don't want to go, fine. Don was in the car this morning, and someone told him that most of the steps flips, and I'm hooked on their occasion by text. Most of the, all of the flips, not hooked on their occasion by not going to meetings. Now, they're not going to meetings, maybe, caused by, you know, if the guy's got a choice of getting late or going to meetings, you got to really think about that one. Well, there's a meeting tomorrow, isn't there? I mean, Jesus. This is now. This is. Now, that requires some operation of the mind. For me, it's meeting, meeting, meeting. And the book is very clear on this. No conditional sobriety. You know what I mean? Sobriety with a condition. I'll be sober if I get the job. I'll be sober if I get the girl. I'll be sober if I get the money. I'll be sober if my kid can get out of jail. No way. It says you must be willing to go to any length. And most of us, and I'm certainly included in that, came here with a lot of old ideas. A lot of old ideas. And when you have an ego like mine, I never thought any idea was worthwhile unless I had it first. And since I had covered everything in my mind and everything was settled, I don't want to hear about what you thought. And it wasn't a question of learning so much, it was a question of unlearning. And the unlearning I learned and experienced was because I had a sponsor. And I would go to him with my problem of fame. Job. I'm no different. I was a great whiner. I went through stages, whining one and whining two. But his answer to me was always the same. And it was like people with me now. I don't know why they asked me anything. I tell them. So, well, how, you know, I'd like to get a better job. How do you do that? He'd say, more spiritual development. And the 12 and 12 says the answer to all of our problems, all of them, is more spiritual love. And I would say to him, well, how do I develop more spiritual? He'd say, well, why don't you mop that floor off? Why don't you go make coffee for the group? Or why don't you find somebody and give them a ride to a meeting or a ride home? Why don't you get a pigeon? Why don't you get a newcomer? That's how you develop spirit. Get out of yourself. New people, all the time. You see me where I live and go to meetings, you'll seldom see me by myself. Always 2-3. I make them, you know, I make them fancy. I make them be chauffeurs. I make them drive me around. You pick me up. I get the guy with the best car. You with the Lincoln. And I have them driving around. Stuff like that. And I want to travel. I take them here and take them. Always have airport. Here he comes. There's method to it all. More spiritual development. They're worried about being at an airport plane. Not to worry about it. Worry about making coffee with the group. They get there early. Get in the inside part of the group, you know. People complain that group's full of cliques. Of course it is. Full of people who do all the work. That's the click. You want to get in? Simple. Start grab a mop and start mopping the goddamn floor. Everybody's going to love you. make the coffee, you know, the physical stuff, set up the chairs and tables. This is carrying. Carrying this. This is important as what I'm doing right now. Somebody had to set this up. Somebody had to. John did all the work. Don did all the work. You know, somebody had to arrange the place, coffee, people did. Guys were serving me breakfast in the morning. Marvelous job. I think it was a long occupation. And you got Hendrickson over there looking like a maitre d'. I mean, what the hell this is? We could take the whole world over tomorrow morning, run it well, if you develop spirit. That's the thing. And it is not, actually, not such a big deal. And the book says we absolutely insist on having a good time. The book says we insist on having a good time. There's a great deal of humor and fun in it. I think it's a three-ring circus. I love it. When I was in New York one time, I took a friend of mine, non-alcoholic, to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I was speaking. And I spoke. I gave my usual stuff, and we're on the way out. Said to this guy, how do you like that? He said, they're laughing at all the wrong places. So what's the matter with these people? He said, you're losing your job and pissing in your bed and throwing up, and they think it's very funny. I said, that's because they all did the same. No. Because he's not, he hasn't had our experience. Then it goes on to say, we are to practice principles in all our affairs. What an order. Go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us is able to practice. No one. Bill Wilson, Bob Smith, maybe me, but nobody else. No one. And you know, I have met hundreds and hundreds of people now who say this. Heard them say, I was once a man. I was raised with my parents' church. Educated to be someone. But I got into the alcoholic way, and all my principles eroded. So I came to alcoholics. And I became, and now I have all my back. So I practice. I've heard very common that. In my case, I never had any principles to be. Never. I was not raised on principles. I'm not knocking the mother who raised me, or the rest of my family who raised me. I just not operate on principles. We operate on need and expedience. Oftentimes, when I was young, my mother would say to my brother and I, go get milk. She meant go get milk. She did not necessarily mean go purchase milk. She meant go get it. And my brother and I would go get it. We saw nothing else. We needed the milk. No milk, there's no conflict. It's big trouble. I was not raised on principle. And I went through life that way. I went through life on a principle of self-will. That I would get out of that neighborhood, and I would get out of that environment, and I would. Huh? Look out. And if I had a lie, cheat, steal, and do it, and I did. And I to Alcoholics Anonymous with that background, plus the alcoholism. So it was very, very difficult. In the beginning, of course, I wanted to borrow my sponsor's principle. My sponsor was a fellow principal. He was a gentleman. He was a big-time lawyer, and he was a gentleman. And I used to think, well, he can live like that because he has a lot of money. It's easy, that principal, you got money, you know. And I very rarely ever heard him swear. He's just that kind of a guy. And I respected him enormously, as I still do. And I wanted to have his principles. I told him, you know, give me some principles. He said they were his principles and he was using them. said, you'll learn something around here. He just, we have a way of doing things, you'll learn. And of course, he was right. Some of the principles are so obvious that I don't even discuss them. The ones I read from the 12 and 12, the ones we all know about, they're obvious given honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, tolerance, that kind of stuff. It's simple. I found out that the truth is good enough. You know what I mean? The truth is good enough. Somebody has something, tell them the truth. That's good enough. I don't have to elaborate on it, give them a lot of horseshit and a lot of lies and a lot of rationalization. Just tell them the truth. Seems to serve. Whole new approach to things. I've discovered, and these are my own principles, and I don't know whether these would be of any value to you, but these are things that have just come to me over the time I've been here, and I consider them to be principles. Principle is something, as you probably know, principles is something that is always true. Rules change. A principle remains true. Gravity is a principle. When I was a kid, going through the Catholic system, we were not allowed to eat meat on Friday. Then one day, the Pope had a dream or something, and he said, there's been a misunderstanding. The way the Catholic Church does it. He said, for the last 1,200 years, there's been a misunderstanding. That has never been the rule. See, it wasn't a question of changing the rule. He said, that never was the rule. So, please feel free to eat meat on Friday. So the whole world did, except for my mother. But that was a rule. See, they just changed. The rule changed. Or they announced that was never a rule. We're lawyers. You know, here's a rule. The case is reversed. There's a new rule. There's a new doctrine. Depending on the personal choice. Principles stay true all the time. Always. Gravity is true here. Gravity is true on the moon. Einstein was right. That's it. That's not going to be true without it. So I had to develop sort of my own principles, really. And my sponsor would help. And the first rule I ever got from him, and I consider this to be the greatest principle I've ever encountered, and it's probably not in any theology or philosophy. Here it is. Mind your own fucking business. That is the basic principle. You know how we are, I am. I'd drive up to a meeting with him and I'd see this jerk would park on the grass. Say, wait, look at that. See that over there? He's parking on the grass. What the, whose car is that? I owe you. Move your car. What the hell are you scared with? Does that affect the way you live? Does that have something to do with your life? Mind your own business. I say, yeah, he's violent. You know, that's against the... Please. You're not a cop. Nobody appoints you. You're not in charge of parking. Go sit down. Or, if you don't like the way they... Get out here with a flashlight and tell them, show them where to park. Mind your own business. Or some speaker would get up and he'd say something I didn't like. So I wouldn't go up and shake his hand. And fuck him, I ain't gonna thank you. You hear what he said? What's he doing? He just says what he wants to say. Well, I don't like when... Don't you mind your own business? Oh. And we'd be night after night after night. Because that's the way I am. I'm out there, I take care of everything. He's violating the attire rules. Look at that man. Got raggedy old cut-off jeans. He needs a shave. Hey, you, get over here. You know? Listen, you, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't run around like bums here. What the hell is this? You know, there's a chapter in the book on attire. Who the hell are you to be a police? Well, little by little. I guess maybe it's age, you get mellow. But it's a great thing. It saved me. It saves me. Really does. And I think it's the basic underlying principle of the surrender. Right now. I accept things that I cannot. That's me. I mean, that's you. I got to accept. I change what I can. And the difference is just for me to figure out part of my business or your business. Your business. I'm out of it. Unless you ask. But as a volunteer, we all know as lawyers, you know the status. We have a guy in our group in Florida, a very nice fellow. And he goes to one meeting a month. Sober, living a nice life. Well, what am I to tell him? He has to go to 7. He likes one meeting a month. None of my business. When he comes, I'm happy to see. And one of the other people in the group down there, we're going to have one of these stupid business meetings. But I don't know if that guy's really a member of this group. I don't know if he can vote yet. Please. Well, should he have a birthday here after all, you know? Say, it's all right. You know, an AA business meeting, they start World War III over whether they should buy the sweet and low, and the packages are in the bulk, you know? I recommend that principle to you. I'll tell you the greatest principle that I know. I've already mentioned, of course. That is the principle of God dependence. God dependence, which is a corollary of the principle of God consciousness. Based on my experience, people are fallible. People have let me down. I have relied on people, as have we all, for a serious purpose. And even more sadly, people have relied on me. I have let them. And I'm sad to say that people have relied on me. And for one reason or the other, omission, commission, what's the difference? I've let them down. I know it. I've tried to make amends for it. And I've learned from experience. People are fallible. And if I depend upon you for my sobriety, as I oftentimes do, I'm running contrary to the basic stuff of the book that no human power can relieve me. If I put my sobriety into your hands, I make a great mistake. I tell a story about a fellow we had, Don and I had in our group in New York, named Peter. Peter was a low-bottom drunk. Little guy, had something wrong with his eyelids. They drooped. He had tried to be a jockey because he was that size. But he got drunk, and they threw him off the racetrack. He was a dishwasher in one of the lower local lousy restaurants. It's a terrible place, greasy sandwich. Peter washed the dishes. And he came to AA, came that first night. He had 2 black eyes. Because he explained to the owner of this restaurant that the owner didn't know how to run a restaurant or something, so the owner belted him a couple of times and threw him out in the street. And Peter stopped drinking. He stopped drinking. He lived in this rat hole. We used to call it the House Beautiful. All the caddies from the golf course lived there. And Peter had a room in this shit heap. But he stopped drinking. And he used to walk to me, because he didn't have any transportation. So I oftentimes would pick him up and take him to the meeting and take him home. And he got another job. He was working as a maintenance guy. And saved up all his money. And this was in the days when CB was very popular. I had one. And Peter bought a portable CB. And he used to walk around talking to in it like he's driving a truck or something. You know? But it was very interesting. You'd see him walk around this town, 10-4, 10-4. And then he saved some more money. And all he wanted really was to be somebody driving a car and talking. And that's why he liked me. I had a car with a built-in. Peter get on, Jesus, he'd jump in the car and he'd go crazy with the microphone. And he finally got a moped. That's all the guy could afford. He got a moped. And he got some arrangement, and he put his portable CB on his moped. And Peter was like a pig in shit. And he was going to meetings all the time. But the main interest of Peter's life was the moped with the radio. He'd bring it in. You know, so he wouldn't put it in the parking lot, somebody steal it. He'd bring it into the meeting, put it in the back of the hall. And we all understood about Peter and the moped. And then he took it to White Plains, New York. York one day. Someone stole it. Peter got drunk. Stayed drunk, and he's alive now. Peter made his higher power and his dependency with the CB radio. And it's pathetic, isn't it? And we all felt very badly. In fact, I offered to get a few of the rich castles. But his power, greater than his own, was his crappy little moped with a crappy little CB. He depended on that. That was his whole life. And it let him down. And I think many of us, and I was like, I thought the most important thing in my life was being successful, attorney, as a law professor, as a judge. And I see that differently. See, Dr. Bob told us all of this in his last talk. Most of you all, of course, the experienced one know this. When he gave his last talk in Cleveland at our first international convention, the reason we had the first international convention was so that Dr. Bob, who was then terminal with cancer, would be able to see what he had accomplished in his lifetime. And so they assembled all these people who soon comes of age here in Cleveland, and a friend of mine named Al Steckman, who's now dead, drove over from Cleveland to Akron, which is not very far, and brought Bob back to speak. And he said, poor Bob, he could hardly talk. And they got him up on that stage. And had 5,000 people. And all of you know, in Seattle, what do we have, Jerry? 45. Well, they had 5,000 people, and Bob could see that he had played some part in the lives of all of them. And he gave his last talk, and he said he had thought about it all since 1935 to 1950. He said, and I thought it all over. He said, what really is going on here is simply two things, love. Love. And he said to us, to Bill, don't be misled. Don't be misled. Don't complicate. Don't get tied up, he said, in Freudian principles. Don't make this a very complicated operation. He said, keep it simple. Two things, the principle of love and the principle of love. And of course, no one of us can do it. And the book goes on to tell us that the best source of emotional sobriety is God. That's true. I'd like to do two things before I end this. One is read you something that I read every morning. And it takes on more meaning to me every time I read it. I think it's just great. It's the last page of the big book. Now remember, here is a book that has been through numerous, three editions, numerous printings. They sell a million copies a year. It's all over the world. It's printed in several languages, saved uncountable lives, and written by people such as ourselves, non-professionals, who just try to set out their experience. Said we are a group of 100 or so who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body, to show you precisely how we have recovered is the main object of this. They get to the very end and they say this. You may say, I will not have the benefit of contact with you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that. So you must remember that your real reliance is always upon him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. Imagine a nerve in these bastards. They know only a little. Imagine how I would have written that. it's what they say. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. You know, people come up and they say, I don't know how to meditate. Tell him, look, ask him in your morning meditation what you can do for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, it's obvious to them, it's obvious to me, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact. G, capital F, great fact for us. And this is Pure Oxford Group. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Now, this is the last page of our book, and this is basically the end of my talk here. And as you know, and many of you have been with me in various places, I go around the country, bring my sad story behind me. And every time I end the same way. And it's become something of a signature for me. I refer you to a pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous, which has always been very dear to me, since first it was written. It's called A Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the very end of that pamphlet, the author takes a biblical turn. And he recalls a time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin, Jesus, as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And these two men found the Lord and they walked with him. And one day they stopped him and they said to him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we have been waiting for? Or should we wait for another?" And he never really answered that question. But he said to these two men, "Go back to John and tell John only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind and the lame walk. And tell John that the deaf can hear. Tell John that the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And everyone knows that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear sisters and brothers, in happy retreat assembled here in this lovely environment of Oregon, if you will accept a report from me, based on my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I have seen and only what I have heard. And based upon that personal observation, it seems to me that the blind do see, the lame do walk. And I know that the deaf can hear. And most certainly, the sick are made. And I have seen over and over and over again through the longest day and into the darkest night the good news of our program brought to the alcoholic who suffers, poor in